This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
This week on Hangar Talk, a new ForeFlight update aims to keep your ride smooth.
And keeping the skies smooth, Ian, the NTSB praises the FAA for addressing ATC fatigue.
Aero Friedrichshafen occurred in Germany. We'll talk about some of the updates.
And something everyone wants to hear, on a positive note, Congress approves a long-term FAA reauthorization bill.
Finally, the transition away from avgas hits a couple of snags.
Ian, are you ready to do some hangar talk?
Let's do it, David.
From AOPA, your freedom to fly. This is Hangar Talk.
The 1056, turn right, heading 130, contact final 132.4.
Turn right, contact.
With your hosts, Ian Twombly and David Tulitz. This is Hangar Talk.
Welcome to Hangar Talk, everybody. I'm Ian Twombly.
And I'm David Tulis.
David, our guest is Doug Veda. This is a guy you met, actually. You and Julie Walker, you guys went to Florida. He lives at Eagle's Nest, which is central Florida.
Yep.
And he's going to talk to us about what it's like to do what a lot of us want to do, the dream, and that is living with your airplane.
Live with your airplane and fly it to work. It is such a cool dream, as you said. Doug was a great guy. He also might be familiar to some people from his work with the Extra Aircraft Company.
Mm-hmm.
He flies a float plane. We'll hear a little bit more about that. And yeah, we tagged along with Michelle Walker. We tagged along for one of the breakfast gatherings, and we went out over the river and landed at a friend's house for coffee and breakfast.
That's cool. That's very cool. So that'll be in the June issue of AOPA Pilot.
Right.
And the cover of that is the Piper Fury.
The M700.
Yeah.
That's another 100 turboshaft horsepower over the M600 and some other features. Dave Hirschman got a chance to fly that with beautiful photos by Chris Rose. And I think we're going to find out a little bit more about the Fury. And by the way, that Fury is going to be part of the GA flyover of Washington, D.C. on May 11th.
Okay, very cool. Good. Okay, so ForeFlight, they're putting out updates all the time. I think this one is what? It's 16.4, I believe.
Yes, because I downloaded it today.
Yeah.
So we could talk
right
about this.
This is kind of cool. And what's cool about it isn't necessarily the product, although that is pretty neat. It's how they're gathering the data. So there's a new turbulence layer if you have a certain subscription level. And what they're doing is they're taking data from the Sentries and Sentry Pluses and essentially uploading it to ForeFlight. And so they're getting these automated, not real time, but automated, very close to real time tracks and reports of turbulence.
Yeah, Sarah Diener reported on this. Now, you do have to have a Sentry or a Sentry Plus portable ADS-B receiver. Just refresh our listeners on the price of that. It's $599 for a Sentry and $799 for the Sentry Plus, which adds carbon monoxide and some other features.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you need those two devices, and it looks like a breadcrumb type trail and different color coded dots that allow users to look ahead and see where there will be or won't be turbulence.
Yeah. So I would think we'll see, I mean, right now, you know, these breadcrumbs, they're a little, you know, they're not exact, they're a little cluttery, I think, but this is the first iteration. I think we'll see sort of more accurate shading probably of various areas like we see now, right, with AirMets and stuff like that. That's my guess. Well, they'll probably go.
I agree.
Kind of cool what they're doing. So you have to have the Pro Plus subscription level in order to see this, which is what we decide, $240 a year?
Well, we took a deep dive into that real quick. And so if you don't have ForeFlight, now, Ian, I know you're a Garmin Pilot user.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But maybe with turbulence and some other features, we can sway your opinion at some point. Anyway, the basic ForeFlight is $120 a year, so it's about $10 a month exactly.
Yeah.
The middle of the road plan, which is the one I have, Pro Plus, this is where you'll start to get turbulence and you'll start to get other features as well. That is $20 a month or $240 a year. And then you can go all the way up to the basically the professional plan, and that's $360 a year. But I've got the middle plan, and it works well. And it does also allow you to have a lot more situational awareness, and I find it to be a good compromise.
Yeah. So they're also offering, if you have one of those Sentries and you want to register it in order to send them the data, they're giving you a discount if you want to add it kind of as an add-on, which is really neat. So if you're looking for it under the layers, it's called Reported Turbulence. So check it out. It's pretty neat. David, fatigue, something that we talk about a lot with pilots, not so much with controllers, but the FAA released some new rules and the NTSB is applauding them for it.
Kudos to the NTSB and the FAA really for getting together on this. So around the middle of April, and we're recording this 1st of May, the NTSB and especially Jennifer Hamaday, who's the NTSB chair, praised the FAA's move to require air traffic controllers to receive at least 10 hours off between shifts and 12 hours off between a midnight shift, before a midnight shift, I should say. And so the science around that is pretty clear, and it makes sense. I mean, if you've ever worked an overnight shift at a grocery store like I did back in the day, you know, your circadian rhythms are off a little bit, and this allows the controllers to sort of get in the right groove and not stack up, you know, early days and late days and things like that. It just, to me, it makes more sense.
Yeah, it is amazing. You know, what got me about this is that they gave this example, and that was the Comair 5191 that crashed in Lexington, Kentucky back in 06.
Uh-huh.
You'll remember that one. They took off from the wrong runway, shorter runway.
Well, they got confused, yeah. And it was early in the morning, and it was a little misty.
Yeah,
as
it
well.
Was. Sure. So what they found is that the controller apparently had been on duty the previous day from 6:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., went home, got 9 hours off, and then reported for work again at 11:30 p.m., and was still on duty at 6:07 a.m. the next morning at the time of the accident. That's shocking to me. I mean, I guess I never really thought about the type of cycles controllers do. I just assumed it was kind of like all daytime or all nighttime.
Yeah.
But to do this sort of around-the-clock stuff, man, that's killer.
Yeah, and that controller only had a two-hour power nap the previous afternoon. So that goes to show you how fatigued you can be. And that was a simple error that resulted in, you know, catastrophe, Ian.
Yeah.
And, you know, just this year alone, we've already seen a couple of close calls. So we've reported on them a little bit, too. The general public is more in tune to hearing about aircraft lining up on the wrong runway or near misses, that kind of thing. That might come down to the pilots as well. But, you know, the controllers, there have been a couple of instances, Ian, where at the last moment, a controller basically shouted into the headset, you know, stop where you are, stop where you are.
Yeah. So, that's right. You know, for pilots, I don't really think about it too much. I mean, I know there are those routes where they will essentially do a daytime shift, get a couple hours, do a long nighttime shift sort of thing. But there's this guy on YouTube. Have you seen him? It's 74 Gear. He flies a 747. I think it's for Atlas, although he doesn't say it's Atlas. And he does a lot of this like, okay, hey, I'm taking a flight and this is what it's like. His schedule is, oh my God, I cannot imagine what he does. It's like all hours of the day and night. He's like, oh, I got to go from Miami to wherever, you know, Lima, where he sits for, you know, so he flies all the way down, deadheads all the way down, sits in a hotel for 3 hours, then has to get up in the middle of the night and fly the airplane over to like LA, where he's like, gets, you know, maybe he gets 8 hours of sleep. Then he's got to go to Japan from there. And it's like,
oh,
it's killer. I mean, this around the clock stuff, it's a real issue.
Well, you know, for me, Ian, just as a general aviation pilot, to me, it's more mental fatigue than anything else.
Hmm.
Even on a short trip like we did last week down to Southern Virginia to do a really cool story we'll see soon on a PT-19 training. I mean, I'm mentally fatigued by the time I've got that tri-pacer on the ground.
Yeah.
And I've tied it down and I've got fuel and things like that. And I cannot imagine going, you know, daytime, nighttime, nighttime, daytime, you know, different time zones constantly.
Yeah, that's
so
rough.
Yeah, this stuff definitely needs to be addressed. I'm surprised it took 18 years for the NTSB and the FAA to get together on this and really put their feet down and say, okay, here's what we're going to do from now on. Let's be cognizant of this and let's move forward together. So I do think that's a great step in the right direction.
Yeah, I totally agree. Hey, moving on to Aero, which just happened recently in Friedrichshafen, Germany. This is the big GA show in continental Europe, and always an interesting show in terms of technology. There's a lot of innovations that are announced there recently in terms of power plants, of course, electric and hybrids and things like that. This year was no different. Lots of announcements with electric, including one from, for example, for Diamond, talking about them training some Lufthansa pilots with electric DA-42s.
That's pretty interesting. And I do think that there's a time and place for electric engines. You and I have talked about that a lot. I think the hybrid version is really where we're going to head towards. But BRM Aero, the Czech Republic-based aircraft manufacturer that we know for the Bristel line of aircraft.
The Bristel,
right? They've got a little bit of a spinoff here, and they're doing a two-seater that's fully electric. And it should offer interesting performance, efficiency, and really in European standards, environmental sustainability. And that's where we're going with a lot of the electric is, you know, to be better neighbors when we're doing flight training, things like that.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to see what comes out of the Bristel Energic, I think that's how you pronounce it. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But again, two-seater, interesting aircraft. And usually what happens over in overseas in EASA will come to the States before not too long as well.
Yeah, that's right. And I should say it wasn't the DA-42, it's the DA-40. It's what they're calling the EDA-40.
Ah, thank you.
Yeah, so it's going to be a Safran-powered motor. And so they've already been testing that in Switzerland, which is really cool. Elixir, which is a manufacturer that I don't often think about, but they've got apparently quite a big order book in the U.S., and they're starting an assembly facility in Sarasota, Florida, and looking at advancing some manufacturing in France as well.
And the Germany-based Electra Solar aircraft, it looks like they've updated the Electra Trainer electric aircraft. Now, I haven't heard much about this one, but reading the story that we wrote here, we say that it was the recipient of the Innovation Award at Aero 2023, according to Sylvia Horn's story. And I must have missed that, but it's a cool-looking aircraft, and that's another one of the younger electric breeds that will be hitting the skies.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Also, some sort of non-power plant stuff. Technum, which is always working to improve their products and offer new stuff. Obviously, they're putting out new stuff all the time. They have an upgraded version of the P2006T. Mm-hmm. They're calling it the NG. They released that. And basically, additional door, some larger windows, nicer interior, that sort of thing. So that's very cool.
And Garmin announced the expansion of its nav database to include much of Europe. I'm sure people have been anxiously awaiting further database info in Europe. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's just the more information you get, the better it'll be. Doesn't matter whether it's the navigation or, you know, advances for safety, you know, like we saw in the most recent years with angle of attack and things like that. So we are seeing a little bit more movement towards some additional features. I'm really curious about what's going to happen with the whole battery technology. And we're kind of waiting on pins and needles to see what company is going to break through and have the battery density and power to weight solved.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. And finally, even though it didn't happen at Aero, one thing that we wanted to make sure and mention is Sea Ray. This is, of course, the popular LSA amphib, kind of the precursor. I think it was the precursor, maybe, or the contemporary, I should say, to the Icon. This is a home built, very much less expensive than the Icon, kind of a different market. But I've flown one of these. They fly fantastically well. They're so much fun. They've been owned by a Chinese investor over the last couple of years. And turns out they just kind of shut the doors, stopped funding it. And yeah, looking for a buyer.
They did. A couple of folks were trying to call and find out about parts or maybe shop for new aircraft, and they couldn't get through, and the website was shut down. It's interesting that the Sea Ray, I know that one of the companies, whether it was Sea Ray itself or the local U.S. distributorship, donated one to the Seaplane Pilots Association a few years ago. And the Seaplane Pilots Association is and has been flying that around the country to let people know more about seaplane ops and things like that. It was a real pretty airplane. It was announced at, can't remember if it was Sun and Fun or AirVenture, but it was probably about 4 or 5 years ago. But the Sea Rays are friendly-looking airplanes, amphibious, like you said. Now, you've flown one. They did have them over here operating at Baybridge Airport for a while. What does it fly like?
It's very honest. You know, it's no bad habits. I mean, it was quite the demo ride. I did it at Oshkosh, and the pilot certainly liked to put the airplane through its paces at low altitude. So that was a bit unnerving, but it handled well. He did this demo where basically you kind of let go in the flare and it just smacks into the water, meant to show that the hull is substantial, and it is. I got to tell you, I saw one of these over the weekend. We had a beautiful weekend here in Maryland last weekend, and we were out on the boat, and I heard this buzzing, and I was like, boy, that sounds like a Rotax. And sure enough, there it was. Landed in this cove that we were in and just took off again and kind of skimmed above the water. And it was very cool. I was like, man, I want to be in that right now, right?
Yeah.
They are just kind of this fun all-terrain machine.
I think they're really interesting myself as well. I know that, like I said, at Baybridge Airport, Helen Woods had those out there for a while. Mm-hmm. I did hear that they pitched down. If you're not ready for it and you're reduced power, it had a little bit more of a pitch down moment. When you increase power, I'm sorry, you wanted to pitch down.
Yeah.
So I knew it took some training to get used to that aircraft, but I do think they're interesting. And you're right, it's in the same ilk as sort of like the Icon. And we just heard about the Icon filing for bankruptcy just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I sure hope that other aviation firms are on more solid ground. No pun intended, but that was a shock to me to all of a sudden hear about, you know, Sea Ray and Progressive Aerodyne.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we'll be right back. Okay, hey, let's talk about FAA reauthorization.
Let's do.
Yeah, obviously the funding bill for the FAA, yep, it comes around every few years. This one has been, as the last few are, of course, or have been, always contentious. What's interesting about this is there's some real issues that Democrats and Republicans have been trying to sort of knock through, and the House and the Senate have disagreements. And so it's been stalled for a little while they've been going through some negotiations, and it came out just over the past couple of days that those negotiations have been complete. There is an agreement.
Yay.
And that we'll soon have the vote. We don't have all the details of it yet, but we can say one of the big issues, which was the retirement age for commercial pilots.
Which was suggested to get moved up to 67 years old to help solve the pilot shortage. But what happened with that?
Yeah, it was stricken. So that will not happen.
Struck down. Yeah. So it remains at age 65 as it has been for a while.
Yep, that's right. And again, we don't have all the details yet, but we can say one thing that is very important to general aviation and that I think will lead on to what we're going to talk about next. And that is that selling of avgas. So of course, this has been, if you've been following this, a complicated issue in part because of what's been going on in California, Santa Clara County, and the fact that they just stopped selling avgas. A lot of other places around the country are trying to follow suit, and AOPA has been sort of batting those down as they come up. Well, now in the reauthorization bill, there will be a provision that if your airport was selling avgas on January 1st, 2022, it must continue to do so until 2030.
That's a big relief for certain states that we started to recently hear a buzz about, you know, local entities wanting to cease selling avgas arbitrarily without having a replacement fully online.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big sigh of relief. But unfortunately, a couple of airports in California really were, the avgas was shuttered in 2021.
Yep.
So they're still in the same situation they were in before, where they've got the aircraft owners at those fields in Santa Clara County, that area?
Yeah, I believe
they
so.
They have
yeah.
to either fly to another airport.
Yeah,
to
depending
get
on what
fuel.
They are, they've got UL 94. Yeah.
But they do have some Swift 94, it. Right?
Yep.
So, but that's too bad. But on the other hand, it's good that other airports in other states can't follow suit in that. They really do have to remain open.
Yeah.
One thing that this bill looks to have in it as well, we just talked a little bit about air traffic controllers. You know, there's still an air traffic controller shortage.
Yeah, big time.
And the reauthorization bill is addressing that as well. And there's still a need for 3,000 new controllers. And don't forget, they have to get training in Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
So, and it takes a while. It's not an overnight process.
No, and this will be the first time there is a specific GA chapter, essentially, of the bill. And so that's good news. I mean, that shows the influence that GA is having over this process, and the fact that it's going to be called out specifically, and we've got some specific protections and assistance, that's a great thing, honestly.
Yeah, and I know you did a deep dive into that fuel issue we were just talking about, Ian, so I'm going to help us transition to that, which we've talked about the story of GAMI G100 unleaded. We've talked about the Swift 94 unleaded fuel. We've talked about the PAFI initiative, which AOPA is part of, and now the latest kerfluffle, or I don't know if there's a better word for
that's
it.
What it is. That's what it is.
is that the NATA, which is the National Air Transportation, is it association, I would think?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're saying one thing that about VTOL or Vital Aviation, which is a manufacturer of GAMI 100 fuel. They're saying, hey, we're not sure that this whole process will be a safe process. We want to make sure there are assurances it will be safe transporting fuel from A to B, from where it's, you know, put together at the refinery to the end result location at an airport.
Yeah.
So they're wondering about that. And so GAMI is fighting back, and they're saying, listen, you know, we're making the fuel. There's a million gallons of it on hand. You know, Vital has it. So where does this go? What is the latest on this? And bring us up to speed on all things aviation fuel related.
Yeah. So because it's so complicated, I think it's probably easiest if we talk about sort of fuel by fuel, even though ultimately in the distant future, I will say the midterm to long term, I think there will become a point where we don't care about who makes the fuel. We're just going to have it at the pump, and maybe it's going to be a bunch of different companies, and that's fine. But for now, we kind of have to talk about it fuel by fuel. So the GAMI issue. So NATEA came out relatively quietly with a paper a couple weeks ago that basically said they advised their members, who are, it's an interesting conglomerate of like everything from a charter operator and a flight school to an FBO and a, you know, fuel supplier, right?
Mm-hmm.
They advised their members not to begin selling a fuel that didn't have an ASTM standard. ASTM is an industry cooperative, essentially, that comes together and creates and then approves standards. And so the current fuel we use, jet fuels, avgases, they have ASTM standards. GAMI's fuel, G100UL, does not have an ASTM standard.
But is that because George preferred not to get it certified through that route?
Well, according to George, I talked to him, he said he started this whole process way back by applying through ASTM. He thought that was the way to go. You go to ASTM, you apply.
Okay.
As part of the process for ASTM, of course, it's an industry, like I said, industry comes together, right?
Uh-huh.
There are supposed to be controls in place that protect somebody's IP through this process, because you basically have to say, here's the fuel, this is what I want to get approved, and they look at it and approve it or don't, right?
By IP, you're talking about
the intellectual property.
Right, how we made the fuel. We don't want other people to... George Brawley from GAMI, as folks know who've listened to us before, he's been on the show before, he's got a product. He's spent a lot of time in R&D.
Mm-hmm.
We've got it in one engine of the dual fuel Baron right now,
mm-hmm.
and he doesn't want just any local person to just take all those performance numbers, all that history, all those tests, and do their own thing and call it theirs, but it's really George's.
Yeah. Well, what he doesn't want is exactly what he said happened, which is he doesn't want an oil company, which has the ability to create this fuel, to take the formulation and create it on their own and not give him any royalties for that.
Right.
And so what he said was that he went in, submitted an application under a good faith process, went to some meetings, and found out that somebody had tried to apply for patents for his fuel that thankfully he had already made a patent on. So he was able to find that, and he basically went back to the FAA and said, look, FAA, I have no interest in going through this ASTM process because basically they're going to just take my formulation.
Because you got to probably have to make it public at that point.
Yeah, well, you have to make it public within the committee, at least at ASTM.
Correct. Understood.
Yeah. And they said, okay, fine, you can go through the STC process. The STC process is very proprietary. It's just between the company and the FAA, and that, you know, basically that's why we have to buy STCs, and we can't just create them and, you know, pass it off as us having the STC. You actually have to buy it from the company. So he says that his fuel essentially meets the ASTM standard, that he's talked to fuel distributors, that they're fine with the fact that his fuel doesn't meet an ASTM standard.
I gotcha.
That's what they said. NATA says otherwise. NATA says that basically the fuel providers, the distributors, the FBOs, everybody else, they want those protections as part of the, you know, they want to be able to hold up something that says, hey, this fuel is ASTM approved. We pumped this under good faith.
Okay. And so, and I'm understanding it now. So they're saying that at present, the GAMI 100 UL is not commercially available for distribution because it doesn't have the ASTM seal of approval on it.
Yes, that's right.
I understand.
So George, you know, he says that he's got, you know, over a million gallons, one, two, I don't know what the number is exactly, but it's around there. He said that this supplier, Vital, has the capability to very quickly produce enough to cover essentially the whole western half of the United States.
Oh, that's good to know.
However, he does not yet have an agreement with any distributor because he said basically they're in the they have, as he calls it, an oligopoly and have no interest in making an agreement with him. Well, I don't want to say they have no interest. They have not yet signed an agreement because they're, you know, they're just essentially being blocked. So until his fuel, to me, gets in a distributor agreement, it's like it can sit in the tank and you know, but nobody can pump it. So it's like,
okay. So know. I did some quick, before we move on to other updates with fuel, I did some number crunching here. Mm-hmm. And of course you have to buy an STC from GAMI to use the G100 unleaded.
Yes.
So you did a little dive into that, and it's a couple of bucks per horsepower. So on the TriPacer, which is 135 horsepower airplane, $2 per horsepower, it will cost me $270 to get the STC. And then according to the story that you're writing now, and folks will probably see this online pretty soon, we hope, there is at least 1 million gallons of that GAMI G100UL ready to go at Vital.
Yep.
And so in my little airplane, which holds 36 gallons of fuel, I could fill it up 28,000 times, or 28,000 other people could fill their airplanes up.
Yeah, I think that's more likely.
Yeah. And then, and if you were looking at a Cessna 172, sort of the, you know, the mid 70s, 80s model 172 with the 43 gallons of fuel, that's 23,000 aircraft owners that could be using that fuel. And that's based on 1 million gallons that we have right now available.
Well, to your point, the tank that they've made this fuel in apparently has the ability, he said they can, over the course of a year, supply California's fuel needs with this one facility, and that there's one other tank that's empty in Houston that will supply the rest of the western half of the country. So that's I think that's a good improvement.
I mean, it's starting to say that the infrastructure is being built out, and that was the main question and concern that you and I have had for a number of years at this point, actually.
Yeah. I mean, to have a refiner actually make this stuff is huge.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole ASTM thing, though, I think got really interesting when we found out about this whole UND problem. And that's because the UL-94 that UND was using, Swift's fuel, the UL-94,
right,
that was approved, by the way, by Lycoming and under STC from the FAA, also met an ASTM standard. It is an ASTM fuel.
It did. It met the ASTM standard. And then we started noticing problems with the UND fleet.
Yes.
So what does that say about the ASTM's approved standards, Ian?
Well, that's a great question, because, and so I asked UND about this, did you feel like essentially you were duped? Did you feel like you changed fuels too early and that basically, you know, the ASTM standard wasn't rigorous enough? And they said, no, I think basically it met the standard. They tested it as they were supposed to. The question, though, is the testing enough?
Okay.
Because the ASTM standard apparently only requires 150 hours of test.
Which is not that much.
It's not. And they said that they did not have any. And if you'll recall, basically what they found after running this fuel for a combined something like 45,000 hours, what they found were a bunch of recessed valve seats.
They did.
In fact, they changed more than 140 cylinders, which is incredible. And they said they didn't find any problems until after the 150 hours. Basically, at 150 hours... They didn't see issues.
Oh, that was the trigger.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Well, and then the other thing, you know, looking at that, we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, as listeners will remember. And so Swift CEO Chris DaCosta, you know, pointed the finger at Lycoming. Mm-hmm. Lycoming pointed the finger at UND. And then UND pointed the finger at both of them, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say Lycoming, to me, Lycoming pointed the finger at Swift.
At Swift, uh-huh.
And Swift pointed it back at Lycoming.
Right.
Lycoming says the issue is aromatics in the fuel.
And these are the extra elements that are added to that fuel to sometimes boost that octane and give it a little bit more gusto it needs to have to make it work in some of these engines.
Yeah, which is, of course, the place that lead plays in the current
fuel.
Right. You know, it is only a 94 octane fuel.
Uh-huh.
These are 8.5-to-1 cylinders, which some people would say are high compression cylinders. And so there is, I think, a question of, was there detonation, basically? Like, basically, you know, was the octane too low? And that's why we saw recessed valve seats and other issues. And UND says no, that there was no, they saw no evidence of detonation in any of the, and visually, when they change any cylinders. None of that sort of typical sandblasting pattern or anything like that.
Because as a student pilot, I remember specifically that my instructors were harping on me about detonation, you know, potential. If you're not properly taking care of your engine, you know, leaning procedures, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so and detonation could destroy an engine really quickly as well.
It can. Yeah. It will be interesting to see if we ever get a real answer about the recessed valve seats because, you know, I also asked UND because I was curious, were they looking for this? Because what happened when we transitioned away from leaded fuel in cars is a bunch of recessed valve seats. And so they found, of course, that if you harden those, that the problem goes away. So they knew this in airplane engines and they have known it for a long time. And all those Lycoming cylinders did have hardened valve seats. And so what they thought could happen, but they had mitigated, in fact happened. And so why did it happen? Well, that's the question. And so that's why Lycoming is saying it's the aromatics. Swift says it's not. But I don't know, maybe I think it's maybe a little too early to tell.
And that is not the end of the story either, because you did further research and get us up to date on the PAFI initiative and the Eagle initiative, which also is yet another, I guess, another venue, another pathway towards unleaded fuel. The Lyondell Racing, VP Racing fuel that we heard a little bit about.
Yeah.
So what's the latest with that?
So, of course, just to really quickly recap, Eagle is an FAA industry initiative that seeks to get an unleaded fuel in the fleet by 2030. GAMI is a part of, they are a member of Eagle.
And so is Swift.
Swift is as well. Yep. However, they are not testing their fuels through the PAFI process. The PAFI process, which is also sort of wrapped up in Eagle, PAFI being the Piston Aviation Fuels Initiative. That's only one fuel now, and that's the Lyondell VP Racing. So that we know, I think we talked about before on a show, that did pass its initial test run. The initial test run, being, I think, some materials testing and then some test stand stuff. That it is in process now on, don't quote me on the numbers, I believe it's 8 airplanes and 10 engines.
Okay.
And unfortunately, it looks like, and we're sort of scant on details at this point, I think we'll get more soon. It looks like with probably most Continentals and Lycomings, it's going to be fine and be able to run without modification. However, there are, I think, as many as, it's something like 8 to 9% of the fleet, which will require some sort of a modification.
Oh, goodness.
Yes.
Is that like a ignition timing or what?
Yeah, ignition, I mean, who knows?
Okay.
Yep. Yep, not good news.
And you know, AOPA sits on that Eagle board,
mm-hmm.
as people do know. Mark Baker was the president of the Eagle Initiative for a couple of years, and every 2 years they rotate out of that.
Yeah.
That is a lot of movers and shakers from the FAA. Like you said, industry personnel, a lot of industry movers and shakers. Gamma is on that, you know, as well as GAMI,
mm-hmm.
as well as Swift, as well as, I mean, the EPA, they're on there too.
Yeah.
They're all moving ahead to try to get something that doesn't have lead in it. I'm curious about what the latest is with the Eagle Initiative. We heard a lot about it a couple of years ago. There were at least 2, if not 3 fuels that were going down that pathway. Now, lately, we've been hearing about just one.
Just one. That's right. Yep. So the other one did drop out. And Eagle is still going on. I mean, the information about Lyondell and VP Racing came out through an Eagle meeting. So, so yes, absolutely. Still very much a play and an important part of this process. AOPA, as you mentioned, still flying the Baron with that GAMI 100 UL.
Right.
We'll fly the 100R, Swift's 100R, when it comes out. That's the 100 octane version of Swift. We'll fly that when we can.
Gotcha.
And share that data.
We'll probably fly the Lyondell racing formula when that comes out as well.
Someday.
So in other words, there's a lot of reporting that you've done on this already and a lot more yet to come.
Yep.
And I guess the main update would be things are moving ahead, but cautiously.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like I think of a potholed road.
Uh-huh.
The road was never going to be smooth, right? It's like there's going to be these jarring holes along the way, unfortunately, but we're all committed. It is moving forward, and it's just, you know, some stuff happens along the way. So I apologize for the long explanation, I think, but it's obviously a really important issue for all of us.
Thank you for the deep dive. No, I think it's super important that folks really get a good grasp on what's going on. And it doesn't, you know, the high performance fuels don't mean a lot of folks that are flying a Cub like you are,
mm-hmm.
the tri-pace like me, and a lot of 172s, we're not as concerned with the higher octane fuel, but we still need unleaded. We still need the option. And don't forget that most of the general aviation flying, just to reinforce this to our members, you know, that are listening, there's a small percentage of aircraft that have higher performance engines, but they fly more than the opposite, than the aircraft that are lower horsepower. It's just because they're people moving airplanes. You're talking about the Cirrus SR-22s.
That's exactly right.
You're talking about the big single engine Pipers.
Yeah, the twin Cessnas,
the Twinkies, all that. Yep. There's a lot going on with that in the Beechcraft line, the Baron. So yeah, there's a lot of interest in it. And we certainly have hardly scratched the surface. But we have a deadline, 2030. That is the deadline for that entire fuel initiative.
Yep. Hey, David, let's do something more fun.
Okay.
Let's talk to Doug about living on an air park.
Hi, who are we here with today?
My name is Doug Veda.
And where are we, Doug?
We are in Crescent City, Florida.
And why are we here? What's happening today?
Well, today was what we call a splash-in. So we invite all of our best friends here that have seaplanes and also land planes. They all come flying in, and we have a nice big lunch, and we have a group get-together, and then they go home. It's just a nice afternoon, weekend, fun thing to do with aviation.
And the splash-in is held here in Crescent City, but what's the name of the place that we are?
Well, we're here at Eagle's Nest Airdrome in Crescent City. It's a little grass strip outside. It's a little private-owned grass strip outside of Crescent City.
And do you live here?
I do. I've been here for 23 years. I happened to decide I wanted to live in a flying community, so I started flying into all different flying communities, and a lot of them are private, so it's a little difficult sometimes to get invited. So I didn't get invited. I just flew into a lot of places, and I happened to talk to a lady, a realtor named Julie Fetchko, Julie was the realtor for this area. And when I came down the street, I saw the house. This gentleman was putting up a for sale sign in front of the house. I picked up the for sale sign, and I walked back up to the house, and I said, "Sir, I'm going to buy your house. Please don't stick it to me too bad." And within about a month later, I owned the house and moved in.
Why? What drew you to this area?
My whole goal was to be able to do things a little different than the norm. I just wanted to be able to fly to work, and I wanted to use the airplane as, let's say, my car. I wanted to be able to go anywhere I wanted to go by air, and it certainly has worked well. I worked out of St. Augustine for many years, and if I drove there, it would take me about an hour and 15 minutes, depending on traffic. When I jump in the airplane and fly to work, I'd be there in 14 minutes.
Tell me what work is. What do you do?
Well, I was the director of sales and chief pilot for Extra Aircraft USA.
What does that mean? What did you do?
These extra aircraft are high-performance aerobatic airplanes. They're built in Dinslaken, Germany. They get shipped, or say used to get shipped, into St. Augustine to a place called Southeast Aero. They would have to be assembled, and then they would have to be certified. And then after they were assembled and certified, they'd have to be test flown. And then usually the new owner would have to get some time in to either become insurable or to get checked out in that airplane. So I'm a flight instructor, so I spent a lot of my time teaching a lot of people, some really famous people, how to fly these hot rods.
What's your background? What had you done before you started with Extra?
Well, I've been involved in high-performance aerobatics aircraft and GA aircraft my entire life. My father was a test pilot, was a fighter pilot, was part of the Thunderbird team. And when I grew up, it was just no question whether, it's not whether I wanted to fly. I was told by the colonel I was going to fly, but he didn't have to push too hard on that one. And we had many years. We had a banner tow business together.
Where was that?
Up in Niceville, Florida, in the Destin area. We'd fly up and down the beaches. Some of the absolute best time of my life was flying with my dad doing that.
What did he think of your flying career?
My father never really paid for anything. He gave me opportunity. It's kind of an interesting. He didn't buy me a car, but he helped me build a car. Same thing with airplanes. My first airplane was an old Citabria. We had to reskin it. We had to build the engine. He helped me through the process of learning how to do it, but then he also helped me build it. And we went through a bunch of different airplanes, Citabrias and Decathlons and finally Pitts and Eagles, and finally got into the extra world and doing aerobatics competition and air shows for a little while. But it was always, the colonel always had his thumb placed directly on me, you know, which was good. And I learned a lot from him. I can't tell you how much I learned from them.
Why do you love aerobatics?
Initially, it was absolutely the most challenging thing I've ever done in my life. It was hard. I was one of the guys that when I was getting my private ticket, got airsick. I had a hard time with motion sickness. When I was a kid growing up, even in the back seat of the car was tough for me. So saying that, I just had to stay with it and I had to conquer it. The other thing, my dad was a pretty fantastic pilot to do what he did in his career. And I didn't want him to know, I didn't want to wimp out. You know, there were certain things you got to do as the oldest son. And wimping out wasn't part of the process. So I stuck it out, and I found out I had a touch. And I found out that I could, in competition and flying with people, I could hold my own against some pretty good guys.
Tell me about a major highlight in your flying life.
I had some, probably 35, 40 years ago, we had some friends, and they wanted to buy the old military trainer called a T-6 Texan. And so I had got one of the Shell Oil air show team that everybody knows. Mark Henley was a great guy, and I was an instructor. Well, he taught me how to be an instructor in an old T-6. Check me out. So I brokered two T-6s for a couple of friends of mine in the Destin area. And so I was flying and having a great time in the T-6. And my dad, the colonel, says, well, you know, I used to fly those in primary, and I would really like to start flying them again. So they called their insurance company, and they said, you know, colonel, we'll put you on the insurance, and you can go fly anything you want. That's fine. Well, it turned out that he had to be checked out by a T-6 instructor, which got to be me. So it was payback time. And I was the meanest instructor you've ever seen in your life. Of course, he passed and we started flying and we'd had a lot of time, but it was a very good weekend for me.
Did you ever own a T-6?
No.
What's your favorite aircraft?
I don't have a specific favorite. I have some that I love more than others. I can tell you that there's not one that I don't like. I've owned a Waco for 25 years. I loved it. Open cockpit biplane, round engine, loved it. I now have a Cub behind me, seaplane, and I try to fly it every day. In fact, my captions that I put on social media is in church, because that's what I feel like. The extra aircraft, I have more time in the extra than I have in any other GA aircraft, and it's sort of become my friend after all those years. So I don't think I have one single one. If I were to get a tattoo, you know, like some of the motorcycle guys, I'd be all over me because all the different airplanes I love.
Wow. How many aircraft have you flown?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. I'd have to count probably 40 different types, I would think. A lot. I mean, the rule we had in the family was fly every airplane you can get into. And he said, you need to do that because you need to see how Mr. Piper does it, Mr. Cessna does it, and everybody else. And I've done that. I don't know if there's many GA aircraft that I haven't flown.
Now, you don't have a military background, right?
I do not.
No. What was your, did you go to college and get a degree and all that sort of stuff?
Absolutely. I had an appointment to the Air Force Academy. And during that summer, my mother was tragically killed in a boating accident. My father was driving the boat. I was an 18-year-old punk. I got mad and I split. I became a hard hat deep sea diver working in Alaska for about 10 to 12 years. And then finally decided it was time to go home and opened up another business and started mending things with my father. Meanwhile, I had been flying Cubs and little things like that, but not really getting focused. Within about 2 years of running my car business that I had, the flying bug really bit me hard. And that's where I ended up opening up a banner tow business. And the rest is pretty much history.
How'd you get the job with Extra?
One of my other businesses I had after the car business is I became an investment broker. I was good at what I did. I excelled very well in that department, but I just did not like the coat and tie. I had met the Extra people because I had owned an Extra before, and so I knew all the Extra people. There were a few very good, well-known pilots that were in St. Augustine, and I got hooked up with them, and they said, hey, you know, this kid can fly pretty good, and, you know, so in between working at, you know, I'd work my finance business for 4 days a week and go crazy, and then I'd come down and fly for free or do whatever I could. Before long, I was teaching down at a place called Aerosport, and then I was teaching the new owners, and then I was ferrying airplanes cross country. So when Aerosport finally decided Jim Mosher passed away, they decided to open up another business, then they were asking who would be a good fit for this. Well, I had met Walter Extra some years before, and we kind of clicked just as a friend. And then the owner of Southeast Aero in those days was a guy named Kramer Upchurch, and they sought me out. And be quite frankly, I thought, fly airplanes, fly extras, make money, or put on a coat and tie every day. It was pretty easy for me to make that decision. I've been flying most of my life. I have a little over 11,000 hours logged. I have over 4,000 hours in extras, which is a lot of takeoffs and landings.
So do you have a child yourself?
I do not.
And no one to pass all this on to?
I do not. I think Walter Extra's kids are going to be pretty happy. Walter used to send his kids over here in the summer and when they were little. And the idea was to teach them American slang. To be quite honest, they learned all the bad stuff first. But now they're in their 30s and going to be taking over his business. So it's kind of cool that, you know, I'm still part of the family. They are my family. Thank goodness we can get from here to Germany back. But I try to do that 2-3 times a year.
Favorite place to fly?
Dawn Patrol.
Dawn Patrol. Tell me about Dawn Patrol.
Well, Dawn Patrol is every morning that the weather isn't too terribly bad. The whole neighborhood comes astir, and there's a couple airports in the area. And we all meet up in the sky at 7:30 in the morning. Usually there's can be 4, 5, 6 seaplanes, maybe even a couple land planes. And then we go traveling around. Sometimes we go down and go eat breakfast somewhere, land in the water, go down someplace and eat breakfast. Sometimes we just bring our croissants and our coffee with us, go find a beach somewhere, pull up, get out of the airplanes and have that. I've actually landed in the St. John's River and gone up into the springs and had breakfast tied up to a bush, had breakfast with the manatees. It's pretty cool. Yeah, that at that time in the morning is just, there's nobody up. It's quiet. There's no wind. The water's glass. Glassy water is a big challenge for a seaplane guy. And we have lots of glass around here. So it's very challenging in the morning. It's fun. We have a great time. I don't think I've ever heard a foul word in years. You know, everybody just loves it. We call it in church.
So that is the dream. And they have it so nice too, because to have access to the grass strip and water, that is just so cool.
Yeah, it was just the greatest thing. Doug said, let me call up a couple of friends of mine. We'll go for a coffee run and, you know, just fire up the airplane, taxi out. And if you got floats, you can land on the river nearby or a local lake and just get together for a little bit of camaraderie in the morning. And I would love that. I don't think my wife Lisa is really that much into it. But yeah, I would love to live on an air park. It would be great to have a hangar home. And listen, Julie Walker went out to do another story that we'll hear about soon in a couple of months at a hangar home area in Texas. So
cool.
Folks who read AOPA Pilot Magazine, just stay tuned. We probably will come to a hangar home near you.
Yeah. All right. Hey, that's all the time we have. I'm Ian Twombly. Our editor is Austin Hansen.
And I'm David Tulis. Don't forget, you can find us at aopa.org/hangartalk and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. We'll see you next time.
See you next time, Ian.
Hangar Talk from AOPA, your freedom to fly.